The second case and last case for our sitting here, 05 AP 1945, John Doe versus Archdiocese of Milwaukee et al. Now we are going to have Marcy Hamilton, who is going to be introduced by Wisconsin Attorney Jeffrey Anderson, for John Doe 1, 2, and 3, and Charles Linneman. And then we'll hear from John Rothstein, and then we'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Anderson.
May it please the court, my name is Jeff Anderson, and I'm honored to introduce to the court Professor Marcy Hamilton, who will argue on behalf of the plaintiffs.
Marcy Hamilton is an attorney at law in Washington Crossing, Pennsylvania. She is in good standing, I'm assuming.
She is.
Therefore, we will allow her to argue pro hoc vici. Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you.
Ms. Hamilton.
May it please the court, my name is Marcy Hamilton, and I represent the plaintiff appellants in this particular case. This case comes to this court on a motion to dismiss, and it raises two common law tort questions. One is whether or not in a child sex abuse case, a claim of negligent supervision and retention can be interpreted under a delayed discovery rule. This is an issue that this court was faced with 2 years ago in the John Doe 67F case, and the issue was left open. There's also an issue of first impression under the common law of fraud involving the question of whether or not there can be a discovery rule with respect to fraud in a child sex abuse case. The first issue before this court, as I said before, has been here just a brief 2 years ago in the John Doe 67F case. And the question in that case was whether or not delayed discovery may be the basis for tolling the statute of limitations for childhood sexual abuse that had occurred a number of years before. Now, in that case, this court did not reach the issue squarely because the court found that the complaint was deficient in that it did not adequately plead facts that would have shown that the archdiocese would have known about the identity of the perpetrator before the perpetrator's abuse of the child. In this case, we come to the court on this motion to dismiss with a complaint that has clear allegations that the archdiocese knew, that the archbishop knew, that in fact Father Wadera had been convicted of child abuse and therefore knew when they placed Father Wadera near the children that he was, in fact, a child predator. So this case raises squarely again, but on a stronger complaint, the question of whether delayed discovery can be used in a case of this sort.
Counsel, I'd like you to address the case of Clowder in regard to your first claim and how you think it can proceed after our decision in Clowder.
Well, Clowder was a decision that is distinguishable on a number of grounds. That is a case in which there was an issue involving an adult who claimed abuse by a priest in a circumstance where the court held that it was would be a violation of the First Amendment for the case to go forward because there would be too much entanglement in inquiring into whether or not the priest was acting appropriately in his role. But that case is also distinguishable because in that case, the question of fraud did not come up, which is one of the...
Just the first claim, the negligent supervision that I have difficulties mm-hmm. with under Florida, because it seems to say that in order to proceed on that claim, you'd be entangled in First Amendment rights of the archdiocese. And so that's the part
okay.
that I want out a
okay.
little bit more, if you would.
Okay. There is a meaningful distinction between the two questions. With respect to the one question in Clowder, the question involved an adult and a priest engaging in consensual sex, and there was no legal criminal violation as a result of the sex. So that in that circumstance, the question posed to the court was whether or not the archdiocese and the priest had acted in ways that were appropriate, and whether the priest was acting as a priest is supposed to. And that requires inquiry into celibacy and questions about perhaps canon law. In this case, what is required is an inquiry into neutral principles of law, and they are those rules that apply to questions of child molestation. And I should add in Clowder, the court did distinguish and say that issues of child molestation would not necessarily be controlled by the same reasoning. So the primary difference is in whether or not neutral principles of law can be applied by the court. If they can be, both under Wisconsin Supreme Court law and under federal constitutional law, that is not a problem. Those neutral principles can apply, and it was admittedly more complicated if it was an adult relationship.
Counsel, I acted, and the rest of the members of the court in Clowder and Pritzloff. Now, the legislature has also acted. I say we have acted, they have acted, and they have passed Wisconsin Statute 893-587, which says basically that up until age 35, an action could be brought. Now, clearly, in looking at the appendix and reading this, that none of the plaintiffs are 35 and under. They're all over. In fact, as I understand it, even looking back, it's 32 years since the last offense or whatever. You can correct me if I'm wrong. But isn't the legislature has spoken? We've had the cases. They have spoken. What should the court do about what we perceive to be the public policy, which is laid out by the legislature? And are you asking us to go against or overrule that or say there is an exception?
Well, there are two answers to that, actually. One is that the statute that you refer to only applies to the perpetrator and not to the employer. The second is that it does not apply to negligence. It explicitly incorporates statutes that go to criminal activity, and so it is a statute that permits civil actions on the basis of criminal activity against the perpetrator. The rule in this court is that this court's common law is not undermined by statutory enactment unless the legislature has been quite explicit that it intended to undermine the common law. So the common law involved in negligent supervision and retention is not undermined by that particular statute that has created a 35-year age statute of repose, but only in circumstances that aren't relevant here.
It's the doctrine, statutes and derogation of the common law. Is that the doctrine you're relying on?
Yes. It's the most recent case would be the Strickey case in 2005 here at this court.
Ms. Hamilton, one of the things that concerned me as I read your brief related to the claim that especially the negligent supervision claim in the complaint was an independent action. And I look at the case of John B.B.B. Dole and, to a lesser extent, the Pritzloff case. And that position seems to run totally counter to our case law. The conclusion in John B.B.B.D. Basically says these are derivative actions, not independent actions. How do you get around that?
Well, at the time that John B.B.B. Doe was decided,
it's a mouthful.
It is. You know, I hope I get all the B's there. In 1997, this court had not yet identified those employer torts as independent actions. The next year, in 1998, in the Walmart case, this court held that they are not derivative actions. They are independent actions against the employer. So in some ways, John B.B.B. Doe is not relevant because the law has changed since it was decided. In addition, it's not relevant because we have got so much more information now about the way in which childhood sexual abuse impacts on its victims. And the facts, the science that we know since 1997, which we've collected in our supplemental appendix, indicates that it's just unreasonable to have expected a child to come forward against the employer just as a result of a perpetrator perpetrating sexual abuse. So in a lot of ways, John Beebe Doe does not need to be overruled, but it is, both on the facts and the law, it's irrelevant and not controlling. Walmart is a controlling issue on whether derivative action is
What date did the negligent supervision accrue? When did that cause of action accrue,
Your Honor,
in your opinion?
According to the complaint, it accrued in 2004. When it became known that Father Wadera had been criminally convicted as a result of cases in California, and then subsequently became known that the Archdiocese had not provided that information, even though that information was available to it.
And you get to 2004. When did the priest leave Wisconsin?
When did Father Wadera leave Wisconsin? Many years before that. He was taken from Wisconsin and sent to California for what they called a vacation in the
70s. So the negligent supervision occurred many years before.
Many years before.
But the cause of action accrued in 2004 because at that time it was discovered by your clients
By our clients and in the world, actually. It was a result of cases in California involving Father Wadera, which released documents which showed the knowledge of the Archdiocese here of his criminal past and their exchanges with parents before any of the abuse occurred with respect to our clients.
Whose knowledge is important? The Archdiocese? I mean, at one point it will be, or the victims here?
Well, the question is whether or not the victim had any of the facts necessary to make the claim. And it was inconceivable to most of us, if not all of us, in 1997 when BBB Doe was decided that there was some kind of cover-up going on. In 2002, we learned about Boston, but a lot of people thought that was limited to Boston. It took the revelations in the Wadera cases in California for my clients and the world, actually, to understand that the cover-up was really quite broad and involved the Archdiocese of Milwaukee in this particular set of cases.
Counselor, don't the John Doe plaintiffs stand on different feet in regard to when they knew or should have known than Lindemann does, because Father Wadera was convicted of a crime that was of public record before the assaults of the John Doe plaintiffs occurred? So isn't that a different test, perhaps, that has to be applied to those plaintiffs?
I'm not sure I follow. In the sense that the public record should have put them on notice?
Right. That's the question is, should the record have put them on notice, right?
That, well, the claim is not against Father Wadera himself, who was passed away. If that were the claim, perhaps that would be relevant. The question is whether or not the Archdiocese had special information.
But if the Archdiocese, I mean, if it was a public record, there's no reason to believe the Archdiocese wouldn't know. Why would they not know?
What was public record was the conviction.
Right.
What the Archdiocese participated in not telling others was that he was continuing to engage in child abuse and that they intended to, quote-unquote, keep the lid on it so there would be no further police reports. So even if they knew about a past conviction, the Archdiocese had further information about continuing criminal activity. And if you look at the appendix, we see both in 1974, we see a letter from a mother praising Wadera and how the children loved him. We see a letter back to the mother from the Archdiocese saying that they would be delighted to tell the personnel board about how wonderful Wadera was with children. And then we see in 1974 that same archdiocese saying that they were literally going to put a lid on this further information about other abuse because they didn't want any further police reports.
Weren't the allegations of abuse 74, 75, and 76 for the John Doe plaintiffs, and Wadera's conviction was in 73, And what is there in the appendix that shows there was other abuse after the conviction but before the John Doe boys?
We have a letter in 1973, which is in the appendix with respect to John Doe 1 on A8, paragraph 38, which is a long letter in 1973 that's provided to the Archdiocese of Milwaukee explaining Wadera's further activities before he came to Milwaukee and describing them.
I understand that, but is that after his conviction?
That is after his conviction.
Events occurred after his conviction?
No, those events did not occur.
They occurred after before the conviction. Right.
But the 1974 memo about putting a lid on this information was about another victim and not one of the John Doe's 1, 2, or 3.
Thank you.
Ms. Hamilton, let me ask you, because this concerns me. Obviously, we're looking at statute of limitations issues. We're looking at discovery issues. Mm-hmm. Your opposing counsel spend a lot of time in their brief talking about the diligent inquiry that is required in situations like this. How do you respond to that? I thought it was a very strong argument that they were making.
Well, there's an argument about diligent inquiry with respect to – their argument is that there should have been inquiry with respect to the employer of the perpetrator, and so that the employer somehow should have been identified to the victims simply because the perpetrator was an employee. Our response to that is that that is an unreasonable burden to put on a child in the circumstances these children found themselves in. It is one thing for a child to be abused in a clearly employment setting. It's another thing for a child to be taken, as Wadera did, many places, to be abused many times, and for that employer to know about it, and for that child to never have any opportunity to protect themselves.
But focus isn't on the victims here as children. It's my understanding that what you have is a statute of limitations that ties into when they become adults, that they then have a window of opportunity to bring an action. And so the focus isn't really on a 7-year-old or a 10-year-old or whatever, 14-year-old, whatever the case might be, but on a person when that person becomes an adult. And I know that you submitted a lot of articles in regard to repressed memory and that type of thing, or how victims sometimes try to forget these things. The other side, of course, submitted all kinds of articles, or at least listing of newspaper articles, relating to how much publicity has occurred through the years in regard to what was going on in regard to abuse of priests. And how do we balance all of these things?
Well, if you look at the newspaper article list that they provided, it is, in fact, a list about notification of priests, individual priests, engaging in sexual abuse. It is not about a cover-up of knowledge that priests were abusive and then were being provided access to further children. That's the gravamen of this complaint.
Well, don't some of these articles that are cited go to how much money was being paid by the Boston Diocese or by the Archdiocese in Los Angeles? So weren't those tied into negligent supervision and cover-up and that type of thing?
Those circumstances still do not provide any hint into the active cover-up of child abuse. It's typical that employers come into the picture when an employee has done the wrong thing and their insurance may well cover it. It's quite a different thing when the employer has active knowledge about a criminal conviction on child abuse and assures parents that this priest is one that should be with their children. And thanks them for letters saying what a wonderful, wonderful man he is. But in addition, I want to be careful about our supplemental appendix. Most of the articles are not about repressed memory. They are not about forgetfulness or whatever you want to call it. They're all about the problem of childhood sexual abuse, which seems to be the most severe problem that children have in getting over With respect to our brief, we cite to the Nelson study, which is on 396 of that appendix, shows that it takes 10 years for a child to even feel the depression. The injury does not manifest itself for decades. So the problem is delayed injury, and in medical cases, like the Hansen case since the 80s, this court has found that delayed understanding of a medical problem delays and tolls the statute of limitations. We now have the science that shows a similar thing is happening with children in child abuse situations, and it seems to us patently unfair that those children are not getting the benefit of what every other tort claimant's getting, but the medical claimants are. So that those are two different sets of facts.
Most of those articles seem to go to the injury being one of depression, are ultimately resulting in depression, is that correct?
Depression, likelihood of suicide, sexual dysfunction, inability to function in their job. It builds over time, and the key science since 1997 is that nobody knows, even soon after the abuse ends, exactly how this is going to affect any particular child.
But doesn't that go to damages if there were a claim? I mean, what you're really talking about is trying to get your claim to court, right? I mean, you were here because you've been told at lower courts you don't have a claim.
You can't even get in. Right.
Right. And what you're talking with Justice Crooks appears to me to go to damages if you can get yourself to court.
Well, it goes to when it is reasonable to assume that the victim has discovered a causal connection between what was done to them and what they're suffering today. And so it's a different issue. It goes to the amount of damages in the end, but in the sense of when does the clock start ticking for these victims, our argument is that it shouldn't, on the science, be ticking the minute the abuse, physical abuse, ends. The problem with John B.B. Doe is actually quite narrow for us. The problem is that it held as a matter of law a child abuse victim, the clock starts ticking on a discovery rule as of the last sexual offense. And our argument is that should not be a matter of law. It should be a matter of fact, as it is in every other tort claimant case. And it depends on the plaintiff whether or not they're going to prevail on that particular fact.
Let me see if I can ask a question. The statute of limitations, in your view, for, let's say, the three Doe plaintiffs against Father Wadera, if he were still living.
Right.
What would that have been, do you think?
Well, with respect to Father Wadera and Father Becker, it's an individual perpetrator, and for the moment, it's controlled by John B.B.B. Doe, which means as a matter of law, discovery was made by the last event, and for negligence, it would have been a 3-year statute of limitations. Of course, for fraud, it's a 6-year statute of limitations. So as I say, the key difference is whether or not the discovery is determined by this court to occur as a matter of law for this class of victims or whether it's a question of fact.
Yes.
But the statute of limitations against the Archdiocese, you link that to discovery.
Both of them are capable of delayed discovery, and John B.B.B. Doe did not involve the Archdiocese. It was not an employer.
What I'm really trying to get at is this. If you have this tort of negligent supervision by an employer, and if that tort is triggered by discovery, and it isn't related to the original sexual offense, what kind of a Pandora's box would we be opening? Could you go after an employer totally unrelated to any archdiocese? For some employer maybe was photographing people in a department store or something when they were undressing or something like that. How far does this go, or is this sui generis?
Well, under current law, under Hansen, decided in 1983, which was the Dalcon Shield case, the delayed discovery rule was held to apply to all torts. The only reason it's not being applied in child sex abuse cases is because an exception was made to that rule in John B.B.B. Doe. In every other case, delayed discovery is just part of the facts. And so if you have a child sex abuse case, this court has been working under John B.B. Doe, which required this court to conclude that by the last sexual event that discovery was made of the connection between the injury and the cause of that injury. That kind of delayed discovery rule has been in place for Dalcon Shield, it's been in place for asbestosis, and it's been in place for every other type of tort. This one was singled out in John B.B. Doe for a different treatment.
Counsel, like Justice Crooks, I'm concerned about this diligent inquiry, and that's why I asked you about the statute. It seems to me, and we all like some, say we're drawing some lines here, whether it's public policy, it seems to me that unless you can articulate how open-ended this is, and it seems to me that it is simply open-ended, and that's what you're asking for, that there is no barrier. That's what you want. And we're not talking about fairness, but an obligation of your client that after they are in their 20s and in their 30s and in their 40s to understand who they know who abused them, whether it's repressed memory or not, they know who they had been associated with to bring this claim. In other words, there should be some end. Do you see any end to this if we open this up? Is there any ending point?
Well, I take it essentially you're asking about the floodgates.
That's right.
Does our theory open the floodgates?
Well, it isn't just this case. It's as Justice Prosser asked. It affects all cases. It could. And you're saying, well, we singled out this type of case in BBB, but mm-hmm. I'm asking, if we were to grant you what you're asking for, what is your cutoff?
This, were the court to go the way that we're requesting,
right,
this would only open the door for victims of childhood sexual abuse who would then, under the holding of this case, only be permitted to get beyond the motion to dismiss. They still have all of the problems of evidence, proof, all of the burdens that any plaintiff
sure.
would have to bear.
But that also, sort of the question that was asked is, well, you say there is a difference, but we have people that will come up the same, say, well, my case is special also, and we would like this consideration also. So to a myriad of instances I don't want to go into when your
right.
red light is on.
But. Right. But the question is any other tort claimant suffering the disability
right.
that childhood sexual abuse victims are suffering with respect to not being permitted to use delayed discovery? And the answer is no. Delayed discovery is just part and parcel of the tort law. And so the question is, do we open the door for childhood sexual abuse victims, especially in light of what we knew, given the science at this point?
Counselor, just one more question before you scamper away on us. You know, it seems to me that your argument goes beyond the new statute, which we've all agreed do not apply
right.
to these particular plaintiffs because there is a 35-year limit in
right.
the new statute. So aren't we running afoul of a legislative policy choice that 35 years of age is far enough if we buy what you're selling?
Well, they have made that policy choice when the civil action is based on a crime against the perpetrator.
Mm-hmm.
So if we were talking about a claim against Father Wadera, then maybe the public policy doesn't weigh in our favor.
Mm-hmm.
But we are talking about negligence, not covered by that statute, and we're talking about the employer. And so the legislature's clearly set a public policy in a narrow range of cases. They have not said in any way, let alone explicitly, that they meant to undermine this court's common law.
Thank you.
So let me see if I understand your argument, very simply put, and you will correct me. If this were a case against the perpetrator, then our case law of last event or the new statute would apply, and you would be out.
We would have some problems.
Okay. This is not a case against the perpetrator. This is a case against the perpetrator's employer, the Archdiocese.
Right.
There is no case law that covers the statute of limitations against the employer.
Right. Well, there's a three-year.
Oh, no, I mean statutory.
Right. Oh,
but
statutory.
There's no case law that interprets accrual under the state statutes.
No, nothing.
We don't have to overrule any cases, do we?
No.
Okay. Your argument, if I understand it, is that the concept of delayed discovery applies to torts generally,
yes,
whether it's product liability or medical malpractice. Those are two good ones. I think the Borrello case was that an oil company dumping oil in a basement when the fuel tank was gone. That's one of our more interesting cases. Discovery applies there. And what you are saying is that the delayed discovery concept should apply here to the employer. And the delayed discovery is the delayed discovery of the victim, the John Doe's et al. Caused by the psychological issues in this kind of case. I also hear you saying the delayed discovery is also based on concept that, your opinion, the Archdiocese has prevented knowledge of this event, the perpetration of the event. And therefore, when a tortfeasor covers up the tort, that stalls the statute of limitations. Okay, that's the negligent supervision issue.
Right.
We haven't talked about the second issue, which is fraud, which in and of itself in the statute of limitations has a delayed discovery issue.
Explicitly. Yes, in the state statute.
My assumption is that you're still relying on the fraud.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we just didn't get a chance to get to it, yes.
Because you probably think you have a little more trouble on the negligence issue.
You know, these strategies are made, yes. But what's interesting about the fraud statute is that it's 6 years rather than 3 years.
And extend that.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in. We will now hear from John A. Rothstein, who is representing the Archdiocese. Mr. Rothstein.
Good morning. May it please the court, I am John Rothstein, and together with Dave Muth, my partner to my side, who also worked on the briefs, we appear on behalf of the Archdiocese of Milwaukee. And despite the sad circumstances of the underlying claim, we're very pleased, and I'm honored to be here today to participate in the court's proceedings. This case is going to present to the court the critical question is the statute of limitation. And because we're dealing with a legislative issue now, a legislative creation, the merits of the underlying case are not the issue. The issue is what the legislature dictated to be the period of time in which to bring a lawsuit. In this case, we all know that we're here on fraud. And the reason's pretty simple, is that this court has addressed the three-year statute of limitation that we would normally think would apply to these cases. That is, the bodily injury statute where you're seeking money damages. That's 3 years. Fraud was alleged in this case because we all know it has a six-year statute of limitation. And under the fraud statute, it contains a discovery provision. And the fraud statute is 6 years instead of three precisely to give a claimant more time in which to discover his alleged claims. The three issues that I think this court's going to have to address and deal with are three. One, employer liability. By this technique, it's just a pleading technique. The cause of action and the claims that are underlying, and we know what those are. This has been pled in fraud. So now they've invoked the fraud statute. But what we have to keep in mind, the fraud statute is a statute of general application to all cases, really mostly commercial. And by that, it has drawn into this case, an interest of every business, every commercial concern, and every employer in this state. And here in the employer liability question is what the court's going to have to decide. It's essentially this. Where you have a claimant seeking money damages for bodily injuries caused by an employee. That's what we have here. Is this court going to hold that there is one accrual period and one statute for the plaintiff to sue the employee who's offended, plus the employer who's alleged to be liable with him? Or is this court going to create two accrual periods, with the second accrual period actually being longer against the employer and unlimited? And as Justice Wilcox mentioned, is that the legislature just recently passed legislation evidencing that it intended in sexual abuse to have a statute of limitation and to have that limitation be equal. That is, you cannot bring a claim longer against an employer than against the employer.
Where does it say that?
Excuse me?
Where does the statute say that? I thought it only applied to the perpetrator.
That's incorrect, Your Honor.
Okay. What language are you relying on, counsel?
There are two statutes. One is a it's an actual sexual abuse by regarding clergy. That's not the statute of limitation. And that statute, maybe Mr. Muth can help me on it. I'll get you the exact number.
Number is?
It's 895, Your Honor. It's not 893. Mr. Muth will get it for us. And then the second statute is the limitation period for it. Here it is. It's 895.71, Your Honor.
Okay.
That was passed in 2004 in that the legislature dictated that for claims of sexual abuse by a clergy person, that the perpetrator plus any supervising organization will have civil liability. And then it incorporates the statute of limitation. It's up till the plaintiff reaches the age of 35, no longer. So it's not an unlimited. The important part is the legislature has indicated that it believes and it has balanced that this has to be a statute of limitation. It should be equal. That's the employer liability question the court will have to answer. Is there going to be one for both, or are you going to create a separate period for the employer that's longer?
Your opposing counsel indicated when I asked that question that that really wasn't involved in this case. Now, what's your answer to that?
Your Honor, this probably comes best out of the case that was just recently cited just last month on the same issue by the Supreme Court of Utah, the Colissimo case. And in that case, same thing. Is that Utah had passed a statute that created a cause of action and a statute. There the plaintiffs were trying to avoid it just as here. And here's what the Utah court said in terms of policy, Justice Wilcox. They said the role of the Supreme Court is not to ignore what the legislature has done. They are actually the final body on statutes of limitations. The role of the Supreme Court is to attempt to harmonize and to have consistency in the law. And what the Supreme Court of Utah recognized, that if they were to hold that they would create a statute or a ruling which would allow claimants today would be barred, they would create a rule for plaintiffs before the statute which would have no limitation. And they viewed that that would be improper, it would be inconsistent and contrary to the public policy. I told you there are three issues. That's the employer issue.
So was that statute that you're talking about in Utah similar to our statutory scheme in Wisconsin?
I can't say that, Your Honor. What I can say, remember, we have two statutes. We
right.
have one that creates liability. And
why I said
statutory
scheme.
This would be along the lines of 893, the statute of limitation, where they provided a statute that the plaintiffs in that case wanted to avoid would have the same impact as what I'm describing to you. And that's why the Utah court says that its role was to ensure consistency and harmony, because after all, statutes of limitation are a legislative matter. Now, the second issue, and this goes to Justice Prosser, about being unlimited in time. This court, even before the statute passed the 35-year-old, ruled in Pritzlaff. Now, remember, the normal statute is 3 years for bodily injury. The normal statute for fraud is 6 injuries or 6 years. This case is 32 years old. In Pritzlaff, the court held in dealing with 3 versus 6 as a matter of law after 27 years, that simply is improper as a matter of law, contrary to the policies to do that.
Let me, it seems like we have perhaps apples and oranges here. I want to take a look at the statute of 3.1b, you indicated that one statute had a three-year statute of limitations, 893.93.1b, which deals with fraud, has 6 years, but we have 32 years or like that. And that sounds good, but when you look, but let's look at the words of the statute, 893.93.1b. It says in sub 1, the following action shall be commenced within 6 years. So that gives you the 6 years. And then B, an action for relief on the grounds of fraud. The cause of action in such case is not deemed to have accrued until the discovery by the aggrieved party of the facts constituting the fraud.
Yes.
You know, so we're not really dealing with 32 years or 84 years or 77 years. We're dealing with, I think, as a threshold question, when did the cause of action accrue? And under sub B of 893.93.1, it accrues within 6 years after discovery of the fraud.
Yes.
What's the fraud being alleged here?
The fraud that's being alleged is by the act of placing a priest in a parish, acts as a representation. That's a legal conclusion, but that's what they allege. It's a representation that the priest was saved, didn't have a criminal background, et cetera. And then the fraud would be, according to their complaint, which is what we have to go on, that when the sexual abuse took place, that's obviously not true, or and then that the diocese knew that this representation was not true, and so therefore that's what they allege is the fraud.
They allege, at least in one of the complaints, that then they would move and they would write an assignment.
Yes,
for instance, I'm just 82 of appendix. In Holy Family and White Wish, now this is dealing with the Lineman complaint I'm looking at. So you have Appendix 82, assignment in Holy Assumption in West Allis for a couple of years, then went to St. John in Milwaukee for a couple of years, then Holy Family in Whitefish Bay for a year and a half, and then went to Catholic Community someplace else in West Virginia for a year, then waited assignment for another year, then went to St. Bridget's in San Diego for a year, then waited an assignment for another year, then went to St. Margaret Mary in Milwaukee for 2 years, or part of 2 years, and then went to St. Joseph's in Lyons for 1 year, and then waited an assignment for another year, then went to St. John's in South Milwaukee for a year, and then was on sick leave for a year, and then waited an assignment for a year, and et cetera. I won't. But I mean, the suggestion is there's a moving around for a cover-up. I mean, isn't that part of the fraud that's being alleged? That's the way that I interpret
it. Yes, Your Honor. That's what they allege, but that's not relevant, and here's why. There's a fundamental difference, and I think a fundamental defect in the plaintiff's argument. To have fraud, we all know the elements that you needed. It's a representation that's false, knowingly so, relied upon to the damages of it. That's the cause of action. That's what a plaintiff has to prove in order to win at trial. That's entirely different, and you're right, to go back to Section 893.93, the statute. The statute does not require the plaintiff to discover each of the five elements in order to start his or her statute. Here is what this court has previously ruled, and this court would have to overrule to hold in the favor of the plaintiffs. In both the Dye versus Strove, as well as the Lineman case, it says there's a duty of inquiry. The plaintiff cannot merely wait until the facts find them. The six-year period is not to discover all the facts for trial, and then you have 6 years to recuperate. No. The issue is when you have enough facts to put you on notice that you have to begin your inquiry, that begins your six-year period. Now, so the real question becomes, what are the important facts? What are the important facts that trigger it? And here's what courts almost...
Let me finish your sentence. What are the important facts that trigger what?
The accrual period under Chapter 893.
Okay, the accrual period.
You
okay.
Bet. What starts the six-year period? And here is what the courts have almost uniformly held by rejecting this fraud strategy. When you're dealing with an employer, and this is the problem why a Harley Davidson, a Kimberly Clark, a GE is going to look at this case. The law that has come down provides that once the individual knows that they've been injured, the sexual abuse, this is not a repression case as the plaintiff has conceded. They know about the sexual abuse. They know who did it, the employee. No doubt about that. They've known that all along. And they know that who the employer is. That, under case law, as you look at, that triggers the statute of limitations for fraud.
Just a minute. Does that trigger, when I look at it, John B.B. Doe, and of course we're not dealing with fraud there, we're dealing with, as I recall, negligence case, and it said, look, you should know what your injury is. Now, of course, you've got conduct causation and an injury in our law, whether it's fraud or negligence, conduct causation and injury. And in John B.B. Doe, you said, look, you've got to know when did you discover your injury was the question. And we answered it saying the last sexual assault. And then we said, and it will automatically flow that causation comes once you discover your injury. Here, it seems to me, with regard to fraud, they're not talking about so much when did they discover their injury, but when did they discover their conduct, the necessary element of the tripartite of cause of action, conduct, causation, and injury. So
you are absolutely right, is that they are not focusing on the injury by alleging fraud and invoking the fraud statute. They want, and here's the fallacy. They take the position is that you have to discover that the defendant knew before your fraud statute begins. That's not correct. The case law provides, that once you know that these three facts trigger 893.93, that you've been injured, you know who did it, and you know who's an employer. Why is that?
Now, that, I think, is with regard to case law, with regard, at least in this state, to negligent supervision or negligence issues. But I'm not sure that it is with regard to fraud. Clearly, under the statute and case law, discovery rule applies to fraud. We're talking about fraudulent conduct. You got to help me with this because I think it's a real stumbling block.
Well, I think the best way to explain it is this. So the court understands that this case would go far beyond this fact pattern of sexual abuse with clergy. This would affect every employer in the state. I'll use the example that Justice Prosser said. An employee...
Is your argument that this is bad for business? Is that what you're arguing here today?
No, Your Honor. But that the issue about whether or not this was going to have an impact far beyond these facts is very important. This would dramatically change the fraud law. I'll use the example of...
Don't you think it's good to protect everybody against fraud?
Your Honor, absolutely. But it is up to the legislature to decide how long a period of time. We're bound by that. And using Justice Prosser, I'll use this example. I'll take this same case and use the same strategy. The employees taking pictures of people illicitly, improperly. And, of course, the plaintiff knows it. That, to be consistent, the plaintiff figures it out and sees the person, knows right away. Now, they know I've been abused, my privacy has been abused. I know he's an employee. He works here. And I know who the employer is. He's working whatever store this is. This is what, right away, I suspect we could take a poll in this room. People would know immediately. Not only does that employee have liability, the employer has liability. And that triggers it. And the reason is, here it is. This comes out of Ohio. Whereas another case involves somewhat complex issues of whether a licensed physician should have been permitted to perform a certain type of surgical procedure, the question of whether a priest had committed an impropriety in sexually abusing children involved no such complexity, so that the plaintiff would need a separate triggering event to apprise them that the misconduct had occurred, or that the church, as the priest's employer, may have been negligent in allowing the abuse to occur. And with respect to
investigation... Again, negligent supervision you're talking about there.
Yeah. Counselor, you know, you're off on a track that I'm having trouble following, and I'm a very pragmatic sort of judge. Let me give you a very simple example that I looked at when I was reading all this. Just say I take you out in the middle of the road out there and I blindfold you, and I say, you stand here and wait for me. I have something very important. If you move, It'll have dire consequences. Don't worry about this road. Cars don't use it anymore. Police have got it blocked off on both ends, okay? Car comes down the road and knocks you flat. You can sue the driver because he wasn't watching where he's going and he knocked you down, but you can sue me too, right? And are the claims same or are they different?
In your example, since you knew that
right.
I gave you that, your cause of action would accrue right away.
But are they the same or
are
different?
Are they the same claims or are they different? That's what I'm focusing on. And you seem to want to make the claim against the diocese the same as the claim against the priest. And when I read the materials, to me they seem different.
Now, whether the claims are separate or the same, the issue becomes when does it accrue? And it's back to are you going to have two when you're dealing with an employer or one? In other words, you know that you've been abused or by the employee. Does that trigger it with respect to the employer?
Counsel, let me ask the question a different way because I'm having the same problem that Justice Rogers is having. Mm-hmm. BBB Doe dealt with a derivative cause of action, negligent supervision. The fraud action that's before the court, in your view, is that a derivative cause of action or does it stand on its own?
Your Honor, I think you'd find case law and policy where it could be either. And what this court has done in those circumstances, for instance, the Korth case, what this court has said is that whether it's derivative or separate, is you don't decide questions based upon labels. You look to the underlying
policy. You don't
policy.
Decide questions based upon?
Labels. You look to the underlying policy, and here's the example. In Korth, the question was that was a parent's request for loss of consortium for injury to a child and also the medical cost. Some would say that's derivative. Some would say it's independent because it's by the parents. This court eschewed or rejected that idea altogether and looked at the underlying claim and said, in this case, since the child can go to age 18, the parents may be 3 years, but we have to make a policy decision whether we're going to have one or two accrual periods. The court held there should be one accrual period for both. The converse is also true. In Joseph W., which was decided by our Court of Appeals, did the same thing in reverse. There in a sexual abuse case, parents brought a claim for loss of consortium for the abuse of their child, and they said we should get a separate claim with a separate cause of action and a separate accrual. But it arose out of the same bodily abuse of the child. And the court there again had to say whether it's derivative or separate is not the issue. We have to look to the underlying policy reasons.
Counsel, well, you're talking about plaintiffs. You're not. What bothers me is whether the actions of the diocese in knowing these priests were abusing young boys and proceeding anyway is a different claim than the actions of the priest who did the abuse. Are they different claims? That's what I need to know.
They would allege different events, Your Honor.
Yes.
The perpetrator, the event that would be at issue would be the actual sexual abuse. And under the plaintiff's theory here, the cause of action against the supervising organization would be what they claim would be failure to disclose the events.
Okay.
But the point is, when you're dealing with an employer-employee relationship and you're going to hold them liable, you have to make a decision whether you're going to have one accrual period or two.
But doesn't the legislature make that determination? The legislature is in the statute, I believe, as Justice Bradley has pointed out, giving us guidance on when the accrual period starts here. And the reason I asked the question before, and following up on Justice Rogensack's question, is when you look at BBB Doe and how the court ruled, the court specifically declined to address claims based on respondeat superior and negligent employment theories because it was a derivative cause of action. And therefore, the accrual period for the archdiocese and the priest arose at the same time. That was the rationale for the decision. If we are dealing with a separate claim, a separate cause of action, then don't we go to the statute to determine when the accrual period runs for a fraud claim?
Yes, Your Honor. You do go to the statute, and that's 89393 as previously interpreted by this court. And why is that important? as previously interpreted by this court, you do not have to know all the elements of fraud, the five elements, before your statute begins. Your statute, the reason it has 6 years, as one court has put it, is precisely because fraud is hard to discover. You have the additional 6 years. The point is, when you have three trigger points, your statute, your 6 years begin. You know you're injured, you know who did it, and if you know that he's an employee of an employer, your statute begins in fraud as to both.
But that sounds like respondeat superior.
No, this comes back to the statute. And the statute, again, has been authoritatively construed by this court to say you do not need all of the causes to know the ultimate fraud. That is the actual language of the court construing 893.93.
Let me see if I understand your argument. We're in fraud now. We've got two causes of action. You're dealing with fraud. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. The 893.93.1b, it says the cause of action is not deemed to have accrued until the discovery by the aggrieved party of the facts constituting fraud.
Right.
Your position, as I understand it, is that the aggrieved party here, John Doe and others, discovered the fraud when they failed to make inquiry. In other words, the aggrieved party can't sit there like this and know nothing. When the aggrieved party is triggered to find out what is the conduct constituting fraud, at that time there's an accrual. And you're saying that accrued at the moment of injury here, because at the moment of injury here, the John Does knew of the sexual abuse, knew that it was a priest, knew that the priest was in a hierarchical church, knew the church had power over this priest, and that therefore, at that moment, they had an obligation to make inquiry. They failed to make the inquiry within the six-year period, or within any period. Therefore, they are barred. They are barred because they have been negligent in failing to make inquiry. And our case law says you can't always sit there blinded, that the plaintiff has a duty. And that's your position on fraud.
Yes, Your Honor.
I think I understand what your position is.
I
was going to say your other position, which I'm not sure is saleable at the moment, if I hear the questions from the bench, is that the same statute of limitation should apply to the archdiocese as applies to the victim.
As applies to the perpetrator.
Applies to the victim bringing suit against the perpetrator.
Yes.
That's what we're talking about. It's the plaintiff's
yes.
that has the
yes.
statute of limitations. Right. And you want the same statute of limitations, even though the statutes do not say that. Well, there's no place that the statute says that.
No. The statute says once you discover the facts leading to the fraud.
We've done fraud. What's your position on negligence?
Negligence is controlled by the Doe case. It's the same thing, Your Honor. I mean, it is controlled. That's just a stare decisis question. And there's not been any argument that they can overrule the decision on stare decisis. And that is, on negligence, again, the same three factors are known. And this is what Doe held, that they know about the abuse, they know who the abuser was, and they know the relationship. Negligence begins too. I think the best way to put it, and I want to address Justice Prosser, I'll finish up. The wrongdoer, you know the wrongdoer, you know he's an employee. If I were to take this case and this pleading strategy were to be allowed, I could wait 10 years. I could sue now the employer. Forget the employee, the employer. And I would simply allege that I had no idea that you, employer, may have known that this fellow had a disorderly conduct or that he had a citation for pornography. This was never disclosed to me. This is a fraud, same as representation, by placing him in a position where he would be exposed to the public. Same thing. And I would then argue that it's a question of fact, and so we don't have to, we don't have to argue about it. We get to go to trial on it. That's the very danger. That's the very danger of a ruling like this.
What about the cover-up issue?
The cover-up issue, Your Honor, is a non-issue in this case. What the court has to keep in mind, there are two different themes or two different theories. One is the affirmative claim for fraud, and that's where you're seeking money damages because of fraud, and that's under 893.93. When you talk about cover-up, that's really the equitable concept of fraudulent concealment. Okay, and you might have a negligence action. The typical fraudulent concealment is that after you have like an automobile accident, an insurance adjuster comes and says, don't worry, the statute's long time, we're going to pay you. And so by affirmative conduct after the events, that's inequitable, that then serves as a basis to estop the statute of limitation. That's not been alleged here in any respect. And the reason is because to have fraudulent concealment, you need affirmative conduct to the plaintiff that misleads the plaintiff from his or her cause of action. And as the cases uniformly hold, mere silence, a defendant who says nothing, is not misleading a plaintiff into not thinking the sexual abuse did not occur, that it was not the priest, or that there wasn't a church.
Moving the employee. Employee is taking pornographic photos, invasion of privacy, and the employee is gone. Employee is at Walmart, gone from that Walmart's. Maybe it's at the Walmart's at the other side of town, or maybe it's in another city, maybe in another state. And you look at it and you say, well, he's gone. They must have fired him. Do I have to have discovery? Do I have to get depositions from Sam Walton?
No, Your Honor. Fraudulent concealment, again, requires after the event something more and in addition. The shower case is a good one here. That was by our Court of Appeals, where after the event, it was alleged that a diocese said to the plaintiff who reported the abuse, you better not sue. You might get sued back. There's possibilities of defamation. That then created an issue where they did something. But the case law is replete. Mere silence by a defendant cannot serve that purpose. And here's another good example. And this has been tried. You may recollect a few years back exploding gas tanks in cars. Well, they tried fraudulent concealment. Same idea as that. Well, you knew these are hundreds of thousands of cars that these were exploding. You didn't tell us about that. We relied upon that, and so therefore now we have fraudulent concealment for all of these. No, there was no affirmative action. In closing, I'll read this. Is that?
I think, though, in those cases, you could sue that company when your car exploded, because that's the first time you discovered this was a bad car.
Of course. And when you, same thing, sexual abuse. Whoa. Once you know the abuse, once you know the employer, et cetera.
The newspapers had loads of stuff about Pintos exploding. Wasn't it the Pinto? I don't want to defame.
I think it was the Pinto.
Pinto exploded, so you own a Pinto. My put on guard, Saab. It's an exploded that fast, I know.
Yep.
Yet.
In closing, this is what I'll leave with the court, by the court of in the Colissimo case, which is the Utah Supreme Court.
Do you have a cite for that?
I do, Your Honor. This was decided just last month, 2007, Utah 25. And it reads, in this case, the plaintiff knew that they had been abused and that Raup was the abuser. They also knew or were constructively on notice that the relationship between Raup and the institutional defendants and of the duties owed to them by those institutional defendants. Specifically, the plaintiffs knew that Raup was a teacher, an oblate, and a priest. Moreover, the relationship between Raup and the various institutional defendants and the oversight functions exercised over Raup were either known to the Clismos or discoverable during the limitation period. This knowledge was sufficient to trigger a duty to inquire into potential claims against the institutional defendants. And in that case, just like in this case, it was a fraud action.
Wasn't there a dissent in that case?
I don't think so. There's a concurrence by Chief Justice Durham.
I was thinking about that, so it's a concurrence.
It says concur in Justice Parrish's opinion. And then the final selection was, in 1992, the Utah legislature passed a statute specifically addressing the limitation periods in cases of child sexual abuse. Although this statute does not apply retroactively and is inapplicable here, it nevertheless reveals the legislature's intent that child sexual abuse cases be subject to a statute of limitations. In light of this, it would be inappropriate for us to conclude that the pre-statute claims of child sexual abuse are immune from a limitations period. Were we to adopt the rule of unlimited time period, we would effectively be extending greater rights to the pre-statute victims of child sexual abuse than to those who were victim after the statute, in other words, today. In other words, pre-statute victims could bring their claims indefinitely because their claims would not be subject to any statute limitations, whereas post-1992 victims would be bound by the limitation period contained in the Utah Code. It would be unwise to create such an inconsistent result, especially where the legislature has expressed the view that events which happened decades ago should not become actionable.
Counsel, of course, this is not a sexual abuse case. It's an employment case. Number two, you do not claim First Amendment coverage here.
That's true, Your Honor. The First Amendment was neither argued in the trial court. It was not argued in the Court of Appeals or ruled upon. And my view of the First Amendment is that Clouder and Pritzloff were entirely decided correctly. Those involved adults. And the real issue there was, could you hold a church liable on the religious concept of celibacy? That's a First Amendment issue.
This is not celibacy. This
right.
is a crime.
Right. And so we're
agreeing. So you don't think you have a First Amendment?
We have not argued that, Your Honor. Right. We have not argued that at all.
Other cases decided that issue?
On First Amendment? No, Your Honor. Not that I know of. There are loads of cases on this fraud which have rejected it, but not on the First Amendment.
Counselor? It's not before the court, then.
I don't believe so, Zett. This court is going to have to resolve this basic question, which is going to affect, as I said, every business. I can construe those claims anyway and dress it up in fraud. This court will have to decide statute of limitations question.
Suppose you lose that. When you go back, are you going to then bring up the First Amendment and then bring it back up here and keep going back and forth? Or are we going to settle this out if you lose this?
Here's my view, Your Honor, is that in most of these cases, this will be a cul-de-sac in the law. What do I mean by that? The legislature has passed this new statute, 895.71. Clearly, new claims that are brought up are going to be brought under that statute because it creates liability. It creates what I believe is one of the longest statutes in our state, 17 years. They couldn't meet it here. But my point is that's where the issue will become is 895.71. And even in a child sexual abuse case, could there be First Amendment questions? Sure. There could be, depending upon the facts. I'll give you an example.
Counselor, before you do that, I think what the Chief is trying to ask you is, are you conceding on the First Amendment? You're done with it if you lose here. Or are you saying you're reserving your rights to argue that if you should lose here and it goes back to the trial court?
That's called an invitation, Counselor.
All I can say is that it was not argued in the court below. If it's up to me, and I'm speaking personally now, not for the client, but...
Well, don't do that. I just want to hear what you have to say on behalf of the client.
Okay. Thank you. Justice Prosser.
So you haven't answered that question.
No, he hasn't.
You're reserving your right to make a First Amendment attack.
I can add...
At least you're not... You're saying you haven't waived it.
Yeah, I can say this, Your Honor, because I am authorized to say this because I know it. The legislature passed this new statute. This is important, 895.71. There could be First Amendment. The client, the archdiocese.
Talk about this case.
Yes. The archdiocese in Milwaukee came out in favor of that, believed it was constitutional, et cetera. But so you know, in that statute, here's the issue. Or this is what it provides. It provides that it has to be a supervisory person who learns of this, who's in a position within power to make changes. So, again, you asked me those broad questions. I can't respond to that. I can respond that, for instance, the statute, we would contend.
That's my understanding from the newspapers,
right,
that the Archdiocese had supported that and was not claiming a First Amendment, but it is not relevant to this particular case as such, which is why you're not willing to bind the Archdiocese here.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
In the posture of this case, I think we are required to believe that all of these allegations are true. Isn't that right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. This was decided on a motion to dismiss, but although all facts have to be assumed are true, only you can decide what are the relevant ones, what are the ones that control. For instance, the most important one, for purposes of starting the statute of limitations for fraud, do you have to know the knowledge, the alleged knowledge of the defrauder to start your statute? And that's a legal question for you to decide. And the case law that's out there would say that when you're dealing with an employer-employee relationship, that is such that whenever you know that the employee has liability, you're on notice. You got to start investigating the employer, period.
Well, I guess the real question that I'm asking is, does the Archdiocese take the position that there's really no redress for these four plaintiffs?
Your Honor, this is an issue of any statute of limitation. If I on the way home, if I am hit by a drunk driver, I have 3 years in which to sue. If I miss that by one day, it's not that I didn't have a claim. It may be very unfair, but 3 years in one day, I have no more claim. It's up to the legislature to decide what that is. And here, the normal statute is 3 years for personal injury, which is really the most applicable. They have used fraud in this way, but I don't believe that can work possibly because of the diligence requirement.
Because of the what?
Of the due diligence requirement, Your Honor, once you know about the injury and the employer. So the answer to your question is, yes, they did have a right, but they had to exercise it like anything else within the time period that the legislature dictated. And that's not for us to decide whether it's fair or not. Statutes of limitation have a real purpose. And that's why the legislature, almost uniformly throughout at least all the common law countries, have statutes of limitation. It just becomes unfair. These cases were brought 32 years after the fact.
Chief, if I may. Counsel, you've emphasized, and a focal point of your argument is the due diligence requirement. What, let's say, the plaintiff, Charles Lineman or Lineman, mm-hmm. Knew at age 14 that he was had an injury, you know, that he was sexually assaulted by Franklin Becker. What due diligence should he have done? Get this out for me. What should he have done, not with regard to negligent supervision of an employer claim, but with regard to the intentional fraud claim that the defendant, as he alleges anyway, affirmatively represented that Franklin Beckler did not have a history of molesting children, that he relied upon it, and that they engaged in either the first cause of action against the Archdiocese, fraud, or the second cause of action, fraud, intentional nondisclosure. What should he have done at age 14?
It's not age 14.
Or what other ages? Play it out for me.
All right. Under the statute, again, this is up to the legislature to decide. The legislature has created up till 18. If you're a minor, you have to do nothing. And then you get the grace period also dictated by the legislature. Depending upon when it occurred, it's either 2 years or 1 year.
So okay. In this case, what should he have done? I understand the articles came out in around 2004.
I believe here, this is from the Washington, and I think this answers it directly. Due diligence would have required the plaintiff to seek out an archdiocesan official, not just a priest or nun, who could confirm or deny his charges, respond to his questions, and speak with authority on behalf of the archdiocese.
So at what age is he? Now, help me with this. I'm talking about this guy right here. What age do you expect him? 14, he found out about the injury. How long does he have to contact the archdiocese to see if there is a cause of action based on fraud or intentional nondisclosure fraud?
You would have, because you took age 15?
Fine.
Okay. He would have 6 years because that's longer. He would have 6 years because if you use the childhood, that would get him 3 years plus one more. That's only 4 years. Of course, he would get the longer of the two, the 6 years. So he would have 6 years until he was age 15 to 21.
You'd have to, yeah, 14, I think, was the last, as I read it this anyway, 14 or 15 until 21. And so this was approximately around the early 1980s. So sometime by the end of the 80s, he should have found out what's going on. And he's alleging he didn't know this until the documents came out in the California case through discovery that there was a cover-up and what was going on.
And again, this is no different. And again, it's a stare decisis, John Doe BBB. I'll use him as an example.
Isn't due diligence a fact for the jury or the fact finder, not a question of law for us?
What is a fact question? Trial courts decide what are the facts, but they don't decide what are the elements that are important. This court, for instance, the trial judge is going to have to go to the Wisconsin jury instructions. This court has to decide whether or not under 893.93, to start the statute, do you also have to know that the defendant, employer, had knowledge? The case law says you do not.
Well, we've kept you a long time, and we appreciate your courtesy in responding to our questions, sometimes easy, sometimes difficult.
Indeed.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Hamilton?
Just a few points, actually. The statute which was raised with respect to claims against clergy is obviously irrelevant. It's not retroactive. The legislature, had they chosen to make it retroactive, would have had to be explicit about that. Under Landgraf at the United States Supreme Court, retroactivity cannot occur without an explicit statement. So it doesn't apply to this case, as has been conceded, and is irrelevant. With respect to delayed discovery under negligent supervision, this court has held in Walmart that claims against an employer for negligent supervision are not derivative, and they're independent. Now, what this court has before it basically is a question of first impression of accrual of the derivative claim, of the non-derivative claim. And so it's a non-derivative claim. It's completely separate. In this court's jurisprudence in the Esser case, for example, the question of the time, the date of discovery, is a question of fact left to the fact finder. It's not something that the court has found as a matter of law, except in BBB Doe.
Is that why the complaint says discovered recently
yes.
rather than a specific date?
Yes.
Is that why you should
yes. And then finally, just a reminder, this is a motion to dismiss. And all the allegations are quite particular in this case. They are quite distinctive from John Doe 67F. Are there not any other questions?
Thank you, Ms. Hamilton. I think you've been before the court before. We welcome you back, and you have been admitted for purposes of this proceeding only. I want to thank both counsel for excellent arguments in a difficult case, interpreting many statutes and many prior cases. So thank you, Attorney Hamilton. Thank you, Attorney Rothstein. Thank you, Attorney Jeffrey Anderson, for your the proceedings today. That closes our hearing in 05 AP 1945, John Doe versus Archdiocese of Milwaukee, and that concludes our